From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Seventy-five years ago today, Japanese warplanes swarmed over Pearl Harbor, the U.S. naval base near Honolulu, Hawaii. More than 2,400 Americans were killed and nearly 1,200 wounded. 18 American ships were sunk or run aground, including five battleships. The next day, December 8th, the United States declared war on Japan, propelling America into World War II. We'll hear from two men who lived through it, one a boy who lived near the naval station, one a young man in Baltimore. And we'll hear from the son of a World War II soldier who has made it his mission to keep survivor stories alive.
Remember these people that were willing to sacrifice their lives.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
It's Sunday morning, and it was about 7 o'clock, and I was downstairs playing with my brother. And this tremendous roar, like it was like something was right over the on our roof. It sounded like something had landed on our roof. It shook the house. With that noise, the phone rang shortly thereafter, and they called my father and said, "You need to come down to the hospital. We've been attacked by the Japanese."
That's the voice of Brian Hagley. 75 years ago today, December 7th, 1941, Brian was 5 years old, living with his family in Hawaii. His father was an Army doctor. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Little Brian Hagley didn't know the big noise came from planes in the Imperial Japanese Navy. He didn't know that the following day the United States would declare war on Japan and enter World War II. We'll hear more of Brian Hagley's story in a minute. It's brought to us by Rich Polt, founder of Acknowledge Media, a company that records interviews so families can preserve a loved one's stories about their life. Rich Polt is with me in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Sheila.
Rich, you recently recorded this interview with Brian Hagley. You must interview lots of people who've lived interesting lives, lived through notable events. What struck you about this story?
Pearl Harbor has its own mythology. I mean, everybody knows about Pearl Harbor. And so I actively went out seeking somebody who had lived through this experience, particularly because the window is closing now on people who were there. What struck me about it was that I expected to have a conversation about Pearl Harbor, the day, kind of what I, as a 44-year-old, think of when I think of Pearl Harbor, the explosions, the images. What I had was a conversation about the impact that Pearl Harbor had on a 5-year-old's life and what it meant for his father, who was a veteran, and the aftermath and how that rippled through his life. That was what our conversation was about, and that was really, really special for me.
Why do you think it's important for families and individuals to preserve these stories?
Stories, they ground our lives. They give our lives context. They tell us where we come from, whether it's a family story or a societal story. I think it's important that we tell these stories to remember. I think it's in our DNA to be storytellers. And ironically, as the mediums for preserving stories have gotten better, I think we've stopped exercising those muscles. Let's record it. Let's take this picture and let it stay on our cell phone. And so I think the onus is on us now to be very proactive, to say, I am going to preserve this story. I do want to make sure that the next generation knows what happened so that they remember and they know where they came from and they can tell the next generation.
You mentioned that you went looking for someone who could tell us something about the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago.
Yeah.
Do you do that often? Go looking for a story, or do they tend to present themselves to you?
Increasingly, I'm doing that. This came out of a post I was putting on Facebook a couple of months ago around the 15th anniversary of 9/11. And I was saying, this event is my generation's Pearl Harbor. And I've said that in the past, but I stopped and I really thought, what does that mean? Why am I saying that? What about Pearl Harbor? And I looked and I saw that this December was the 75th anniversary of that event. It seemed like as good a time as any to proactively go out and find somebody. And I, you know, over the course of 2 weeks and 6 degrees of separation, I tracked down a local survivor. I went in thinking I was going to find a vet. And in fact, what I found was the child of a vet and a very different take on that day.
I'm really grateful to you for bringing his story to On the Record. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Here's more of Rich Polt's interview with Brian Hegley, who was 5 years old when he heard the frightening noise of the Japanese planes attacking Pearl Harbor. His father, an Army doctor, was stationed there.
And he got dressed like he was going to work. I remember seeing him put on his tie. And he took me out back. And we had a very small back porch. And all you could see was a lot of smoke and a lot of noise, sirens going back and forth. And he said, he pointed to the sky, he looked, he said, look at that. He said, I want you to remember this. That's all he said. And then he was off. And then we couldn't find my brother. My mother's panicking. We're running around the house. It turns out my brother Steve was in a closet playing with his trucks. I guess the noise got to him. We were evacuated. All the dependents were evacuated. They took us up into the hills, and we were at a school, and I remember having to sleep. They had these grass mats, and I slept on those on the floor. But they kept us up there because they thought that the enemy would come back. I know my mother always talks to you, we didn't hear from your father for 2 weeks. Now, how long we were up there, I don't know that. But I do know this, that we had Christmas there. And we didn't leave Hawaii until after Easter. We were shipped back by Army convoy, not luxury liner. And I distinctly remember this. They spotted enemy submarine. We had to man the lifeboats. We had vests on. They're ready to hoist us down. The destroyer took the Japanese sub out. Thank God for that. My father then came back. We saw him for a short while. And then he was sent down to North Carolina. He was being trained to go over to northern France. He had the distinction of being in two theaters of war, the Pacific and the European. It left a mark. It was a terrible thing. My father died of a post-traumatic stress disorder, 41 years old, took his life. He suffered a lot. He had nightmares. He'd scream. He left my mother with, you know, three. My mother's 39 years old. So left her with three boys, never would remarry. And she said, I could only love one man. First of all, they wanted to bury him at Arlington. And she said, I'm not going to Arlington. It's too far. I'm from Baltimore. I'm not riding over there. So he was buried out in the National Cemetery on Frederick Road. There's a National Cemetery there. You know, I was in the seventh grade, and it was a military funeral. And I had my uniform on because I was in military school. And It was a little rough at that time, you know. People would hide everything back then. I don't know if you're familiar. You know that there are 22 veterans every day that take their lives. In the First World War, they called it shell shock. Yeah. Second World War, they called it battle fatigue. And recently, they sophisticated called it post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's all the same damn thing. But they never paid much attention to it. I didn't even know that my father's death was that until I was older. My mother wouldn't talk about it.
What does it mean to you to have been there at Pearl Harbor during the attack?
I was part of a historical matter that happened in this country. I'm not taking credit for a thing. I just happened to be there. And change this country. It certainly helped make it what it is today. I think we're forgetting a lot of that. I think we have to keep certain memories alive to remember the foundation of this country, what we did. And I don't think it will ever be matched again. I've told the story so many times. I was fortunate to survive it, I guess.
That was Brian Hegley of Cockeysville, Maryland, recounting the events of December 7, 1941. He was 5 years old and living with his family in Hawaii during the attack on Pearl Harbor. This conversation was produced and shared with On the Record by Rich Polt of Acknowledge Media. I'm Sheila Cast. Quick break now on the record, and then more about the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago, in which 2,403 Americans lost their lives. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. In a couple of hours, it will be precisely 75 years since the Japanese military began its attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. We just heard part of the story of someone who lived through the attack as a child, Brian Hegley, the son of an Army physician. Now we're going to meet an author, the son of another soldier who lived through the Pearl Harbor attack. Paul Travers has compiled the oral histories of his father, Herman, and other survivors of Pearl Harbor in a book titled Eyewitness to Infamy. Paul Travers is here with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila. It's a pleasure to be here today.
In your book, you call your late father, Herman J. Travers, a poster boy for the greatest generation. Why?
He was a child of the Depression. He dropped out of high school in the ninth grade to work down at the canneries along the Canton waterfront to support his family. And then when the next sibling became of age, my father was free to follow his dream. And that dream eventually led him to the recruiting office in downtown Baltimore. First, he went to the Marine Corps. He had bad feet. They wouldn't take him. Went to the Navy. He had bad teeth. They wouldn't take him. So ironically, the Army welcomed him with open arms. And he was enlisted as an infantryman, so I found that kind of ironic. And then he shipped off to Pearl Harbor, probably at the end of 1940. He's an honor graduate in basic training. He graduates at PFC. So in essence, my father was a soldier, and his military career was cut short after Pearl Harbor. Here he is not even a high school graduate, right? He's selected to go to Officer's Candidate School at Fort Benning, Georgia, goes there, graduates, shipped back to the Pacific. Eventually, he ends up fighting alongside the Marines on the Isle of Palau, where he's severely wounded in a Japanese ambush. Comes back to the stateside, finally is discharged from Valley Forge Hospital in 1947. Marries the girl of his dreams that he met during World War II when he was home on leave at a neighborhood social outing, and then picks up the pieces of his life. Worked his whole life as a window clerk for the U.S. Post Office in Baltimore here. And then later on in life, the battle wasn't over. He battled Alzheimer's disease. So eventually he succumbed to that, kind of, I would say, bowed, bloodied, but not broken. Even late at night, the nurses would tell me my father was rather a docile patient, a very peaceful man. But when I would go in to see him during the day, sometimes the nursing staff would pull me aside and say, "Your father had a rough night." And I'd say, "What do you mean a rough night?" He said he was fighting the ghosts from World War II again. He'd be calling out names of men in his platoon, you know, that passed away back during World War II, and he'd be barking out orders. And my father really took it hard for the men that were killed under his command. And when I was speaking with him, and he never really talked too much about the war, but he said the hardest thing he ever had to do was write letters of condolences back to the families of those members in his unit that were killed.
That was after he was an officer. That was,
yes.
That was not at Pearl Harbor. You say he did not talk much about the war. So growing up, what was your awareness of Pearl Harbor?
Just that my father was there. He would always refer to himself as not as an eyewitness or survivor. He would just say, "I was just there." But, you know, he always downplayed his role, and that was typical of the men and women of that generation. You know, they always deferred any recognition or glory to other people. It was always we and not me, you know, if you were back in the military back then, because there was other people. You know, my father had seen had men who made the supreme sacrifice.
How did he get involved in the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association in the Baltimore chapter?
He really wasn't for most of his life. And there was a lady, Myrtle Watson, who was a nurse at the Schofield Army Hospital. And she was very active in the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. And then one day she comes into the post office to mail packages to her daughter in Hawaii. And my father happened to be the window clerk that day. So, of course, he sees the packages to Hawaii. They strike up a conversation. And then, you know, she finds out he was at Schofield Barracks with the 27th Infantry Regiment. And then he finds out that she was a nurse at Schofield Army Hospital. And that's how that friendship evolved. And eventually, Myrtle Watson got my father involved in the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association.
That's Paul Travers here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kest. Paul Travers is the son of a Pearl Harbor survivor and has published a book of oral histories of survivors, Eyewitness to History and Oral History of Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941, is the title of the book. You published Eyewitness to Infamy 25 years ago and then updated and republished it a couple months ago. How many survivors' stories do you tell?
We have 48. And then in the updated preface, I include probably about four or five more.
Of course, some of the updates were that so many of the survivors have died, just the passage of the years.
Yes, we're actually coming down to the concept of the last man standing.
You've mentioned Myrtle Watson a couple of times. An Army nurse gave you an amazing account, a really compelling account of what she experienced on December 7th. Can you share with us some of the particular words that she gave you?
I would love to read a little excerpt from her narrative. And before I do, let me say, if there's an unsung hero from the day in infamy, you know, it's got to be Myrtle Watson. Because, you know, there weren't a lot of women there in military roles, and Myrtle Watson was one of them. And I call her the First Lady of, you know, December 7th, 1941, because she was just always supportive, especially of me, you know, in writing the book.
So pick up the story.
Yes. In the words of Myrtle Watson, I was standing in the doorway looking at the planes with an injured GI named Jack. He always called me Chick because of my blonde hair. Chick, I think we're at war, he said as he saw the airplanes fly by. We couldn't be at war. Someone would tell us, I said rather shakily. We just stood frozen in our places staring at the sky as the planes made their runs. The effect was almost hypnotic. Planes were flying so low you could see the goggles and the scarves on the pilots. The sound of the gunfire and the drone of the plane engines intensified when suddenly Jack shoved me aside to the floor of the porch. A line of bullets was cutting a path from the ground and up to the side of the building. Two heavy bullets lodged in the door frame right where my knees would have been. I almost became a patient in my own ward. The only thing I lost in the ordeal was my nurse's cap. After I got back inside the ward, I began cutting some of the guys out of traction and moving them under their beds. As the strafing was still going on, I piled my mattresses around them, then climbed under the bed with them. So that's a pretty descriptive narrative of someone's experience at Pearl Harbor. Not from someone who was actually at the harbor itself, but someone who was, you know, in a hospital ward, caring for the injured as they came in.
And she served the entire war. She was stationed in Hawaii.
Yes, in Hawaii.
There is a memorial service at noon today aboard the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Taney. Tell us about that.
It's held every year. It's sponsored by the historic ships in Baltimore. And the gentleman who really puts it all together is Paul Cora, who is the curator for the historic ships in Baltimore.
The ship, the Coast Guard cutter itself, is significant.
Yes, it is the last warship afloat from the Japanese attack. The Taney was not in Pearl Harbor, it was in Honolulu Harbor, but it was there for the attack. Now, the last ship or vessel is the tugboat Hoga. It actually has the claim of being the last ship at Pearl Harbor. Now, it wasn't a warship. It was just a yard tug.
But the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Taney is a warship.
Yes.
So you're going to be speaking. What is your message?
My message will be to remember these people, to connect with their stories. You know, we are becoming desensitized, I think, in our modern age, the concept of war. War has become remote control, a push-button affair. To remember these people that were willing to sacrifice their lives and to carry on their message of keep America alert, remember Pearl Harbor, because that message resonates today. And I can think of no other example than what happened at 9/11. I watched it all unfold on TV, and all I could see was, you know, the burning buildings and the bodies. And, you know, right away it flashed back to me the images of Pearl Harbor, and, you know, we have to keep alert. You know, we're the same people. We're in a different age. we have to keep in touch with our humanity in situations like this. And that's a plus about an oral history that deals with, say, World War II, because it connects us to the people that were there.
I really appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and thank you for remembering those men and women from Pearl Harbor.
Paul Travers, son of a survivor of the Pearl Harbor attack, has compiled a book of oral histories titled Eyewitness to Infamy, An Oral History of Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941. I also spoke with Gil Sandler, the man behind WIPR's Baltimore Stories and the author of Homefront Baltimore, an album of stories from World War II. I asked Gil how Baltimore reacted to the news of the Pearl Harbor attack.
Well, actually, Baltimore was at war before America was, because we had these huge war plants, Glen L. Martin, Bethlehem Shipyards. This city was already approaching overcrowding a million people. I mean, people were coming in. They were hiring thousands a day in 1938, 1939, 1940. So when the war came, this was already a city at war. We had three shifts of workers around the clock. Downtown was crazy all night long. We, being a city that was in the middle of war production, it came as a surprise, of course, that this was the way the war was going to be. Nobody knew that. But when it hit, everybody was stunned. It was Sunday afternoon, about 12 o'clock, as I remember, 12:15. Of course, everybody who was anywhere came home to find out what was going on. And, of course, the next day, as I remember it, Roosevelt made his famous speech, and everybody was tuned to the radio. There was no television. And he made his famous speech about yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a day that will live in infamy. That, of course, set everybody on a different track of what to do with their lives. High school students, college students, anybody between 16 and 40 was on a list somewhere. And if you didn't volunteer for one of the services, you could expect to be drafted. And then came this famous greetings from the Secretary of War. You have been selected to serve your country and so forth. So most people were making plans. Students were making plans to either get deferments or join one of the various services. High school students were rethinking their college plans. There was a lot of protesters, believe it or not. There was an anti-war sentiment in Baltimore at the time, too. Not everybody was in favor of the war, even when it hit. So there was a lot of readjusting of thinking. But the larger story there was that you knew at that instant that you had to refigure your life.
Even after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there was a protest. There was an
anti-war
movement. I believe
so. I can't remember exactly the form it took, but there was a strong anti-war movement in the United States. As a matter of fact, Roosevelt, as you know, had a difficult time getting the country behind him, and I don't think it ended quite with Pearl Harbor, or much of it did, of course, but there was still a lot of protesting and conscientious objectors, too. But by and large, overwhelmingly, the recruiting stations were open all night long. All night long.
All night December 7th, or all night for a long time?
I don't know when they stopped going all night long, but they were open for several days because the lines never stop. It was the last good war, as people say. Most everybody wanted a piece of this thing. They wanted to fight. They wanted to fight for their country. We had been bombed. We had been wronged. We had been usurped. And so everybody wanted to be a part of that. And young men lined up from the post office building where they recruited down to the train stations.
You said everybody was rethinking what this meant.
Well,
rethinking their lives. What did it mean for your life?
Well, if you were working in a non-defense industry, you knew that materiel for your manufacturing, if that's what you were doing, was going to be rationed. And some businesses actually went out. They manufactured no automobiles and no refrigerators and no radios, things like that, during the war. If you were in production of that, you were out of business. So you had to rethink your life. That was one aspect of it. If you were in college, you were subject to the draft, and you had to work through that. Were you going to stay in, look for a deferment, certain programs gave you these deferments, you had to rethink that. Or many just said, I'm going in regardless. And many, so people went in different ways. And everybody was rethinking their lives. And the process began December 7th, 1941, at about 12:30 Baltimore time.
Gil Sandler, remembering the attack on Pearl Harbor 75 years ago today. The memorial ceremony aboard the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Taney at noon is free and open to the public at the Inner Harbor, Pier 5, 701 East Pratt Street. More information at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening to On the Record. Join us again tomorrow.